This is the Gator Nation Football Podcast with your hosts, Alan Williams and James DeVirgilio.
This place is an insane asylum in the swamp! Oh my!
Now we know we're just a bunch of average stiffs.
This is the Gator Nation Football Podcast. I'm James DeVirgilio alongside Alan Williams. This is episode 2 of the 2018 season, our spring mailbag. And at the end of the episode, a little bit of basketball talk, whatever. It's the spring. We can say whatever we want on this show, right? Alan joining me from Moscow. Very interesting political relations. We could have an entire podcast, I'm sure, on that. Alan, how are you this fine March day?
I'm great. Just digging myself out from under the snow. Had a ton of snow the last couple weeks. It's beautiful and white here in Moscow. Come on over, James. Come and hang out.
If only I can get a visa. But Alan, we wanted to do this mailbag episode to give you guys a chance to sort of ask some questions here in the peak of the off season. Spring football hasn't quite started yet for the Gators. Sort of in this doldrum period. Kind of get your thoughts. What are you thinking about? Answer your questions. Spur up some discussion and analysis. And we open it up to our Patreon supporters. Thank you guys for providing us with some great material. And thank you so much for supporting us. If you're interested in becoming a supporter on Patreon, you can find those links on our Twitter page or our Facebook page. And certainly, Alan and I appreciate those donations immensely. All right, Alan. With that, I'm going to let you walk us through the first couple of questions here. These are some good ones. And let's just jump right into it.
Yeah, thanks for everybody who put a question in. We got kind of some similar QB questions from Chris Perales, T. Carter Tan, and Tyler James Rummery, along with Jeff H. So a lot of people want to know, what do we think about Franks this coming up season? Felipe Franks, our erstwhile starting QB. Is he salvageable? Can he effectively run what Mullen wants to do? Is there any hope for him in this new look offense? What do you think, James?
Well, let's start with this first piece of this question first. Was there anything that Franks showed us last year that made us think he's the one to beat? I'll answer this one first, Alan, then I'll pitch it to you. No. For me, no. And especially because this offense we're running this year, I do not think fits his skill set, which also goes into the question that T. Carter Tan on Twitter asked us, which is essentially, can Franks run what Mullen wants to do? No, he cannot. I don't think that, judging by the first year of film we've seen in his high school film, that he's well suited to run this offense. And before I get into some of the details on that, I'm just going to simply answer this question with a no, he cannot. And I believe that Mullen is well aware of this, even if Mullen was talking up Franks' arm, which is the right thing to do. Praise your players publicly, encourage competition. But I think Mullen knows very, very well that Franks is not a good fit for this offense.
Yeah, it's tough because I don't want to completely put Franks just in the garbage can and say there's no hope for him. He's an athletic guy. If you saw on Twitter with the basketball team or the football team playing some basketball, him doing like a follow-up dunk. I mean, he's 6'5 and athletic, so there's some tools there. It's what he made him such a highly ranked recruit, highly sought after guy. I don't think he can really do what Dan wants him to do, but could they create an offense that he can, I don't know if flourish is the right word, but he could be adequate in? I think so. I think there's a future where, let's say the other quarterbacks aren't working out for some reason, that we can see an adequate offense with Felipe Franks at the helm. I don't think it would be the offense that Dan Mullen wants to run. So is he salvageable in the sense that you could get him to be a functioning player? Yes. Is he salvageable in the sense that he's going to live up to his star ranking and his kind of profile as a recruit? No, I don't think so. Not here at the University of Florida under Dan Mullen. So that's unfortunate for him. But apparently he's a good dude, works hard. So maybe there's a future for him if it doesn't work out with some of these other guys.
As I mentioned on Alan, as I mentioned on our episode 1 podcast, to hop in here for a second, I would fully expect Franks to transfer if he wants to pursue maximizing his skill set. It seems like Franks really does love being a Gator, and it seems like he's a very good-natured guy. So it's a chance he does not pursue that avenue. If I were counseling him, I would say that he needs to move on after the spring. I cannot see any realistic scenario where he beats out Emory Jones. I've watched both of them on film extensively. Emory Jones is extremely good at throwing on the run. I'm very impressed when I put on his high school tape about how well he can roll to the left and throw. That's a very difficult thing to do. He spent his entire offensive career running the same exact offense Dan Mullen runs, albeit a much simpler version, but the same exact thing. So you can kind of liken this to turning on a brand new video game, and maybe you've played hundreds of hours of video games, but you haven't played this brand new particular game. And the guy you're going up against has played that entire game for 500-600 hours. You're way behind that curve. And that's kind of the Franks and Emory Jones discussion, on top of which you never know what a player may look like with the kind of coaching we had last year and the kind of stuff we were running. But this offense in particular seems ill-suited to how a guy like Franks wants to play the game. I'm just not sure it's a good fit. I would imagine the best case scenario for Franks is that he loses the job, he moves out, he goes to a different school, and then maybe a guy like Jake Allen kind of stays. But I don't know. There's a very real scenario, Allen, here that we're going to talk a lot about next year, that if Emory Jones gets hurt, who comes in and what does the offense look like? And that's primarily the question that Tyler's running. And I think the real answer to this question, to be candid, is we don't know what Dan Mullen will do with a guy like Franks. He's never utilized a guy like Franks in an offense before, and we have no idea how it would look. I know how I might handle that, but that's not the question being asked. It's what do we think it would look like? And I think it would be bad, because I definitely believe that Dan Mullen is a system quarterback, a run-first kind of guy. That's why we got Emory Jones, why we flipped him from Ohio State and Alabama late in the game. I think he realized the opportunity he had to start right away and get 2 or 3 years of development under Dan Mullen. I think all those things are writing on the wall for a guy like Franks, and now you're sort of getting this talk about, hey, look, Franks can be good. We've got to build up these other quarterbacks, because Mullen recognizes we have to have a backup quarterback, Allen. There's got to be a guy that he can put packages in for, because if Emory wants to run the ball at all, there's a very good chance he misses some snaps next season. And that is, without a doubt, I think the gravest concern that Dan Mullen has strategically when addressing this team's needs and the upcoming season.
So part of the question that Jeff H. asked was, you know, who do you think will start at QB next year? Obviously, you've already just said that you think it'll be Emory Jones. Would you put that at like 90% he's going to start?
I would put that at this point. Yeah, I'd actually put that at like 99.9, barring an injury. And okay. And I'm not at practice, but we said, Allen, in December, if you recall, the very first thing we talked about is Dan Mullen has to go out and get a quarterback. He is going to go all in on getting a quarterback that fits his system. And lo and behold, he did just that. He basically allowed Matt Corral to go, a guy that was highly thought of, really kind of just let that dwindle, and then really focused in on Emory Jones and a host of other guys, because I think he recognized that he had to have that guy. Now, interestingly enough, Emory Jones is still raw. I think there's a lot of things, Allen, he doesn't do super well, especially in the pocket. I think he's going to struggle to throw to receivers that are far more covered in the SEC. I don't think it's going to be a light the world on fire freshman year for him, but Dan had to have that kind of guy. And Emory Jones is a highly touted guy. In fact, I was just reading last week that had he gone to Ohio State, Emory Jones would have been the highest ranked dual threat quarterback, Allen, that Urban Meyer had recruited. So Emory is a very solid guy. I think it's maybe easy for some of us even to sleep on that, but he is the guy for this offense. Franks is not the guy for this offense, and Franks was always a long-term project. I still think, to sort of put a bow on this, that Franks could become a very interesting quarterback prospect if he took the proper track and got the proper coaching, given his God-given athletic talents and his ability to throw a football. He has an incredibly gifted arm, but he needs a lot of development, and this system is the absolute worst one for him.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued by Jake Allen just because he's such a complete unknown. I mean, I've seen Kyle Trask throw the ball a little bit in spring games, and, you know, just kind of his profile out of high school. I feel like I don't know if I have a read on him, but we know something about him at least. Could Jake Allen step in and, you know, be a little more polished, and the staff is worried about Emory Jones week one? You know, I don't know. Maybe Jake Allen sees the field if Felipe Franks transfers. we're going to talk about this a lot, I'm sure, as the first couple weeks come up, but he's a little bit, I don't know if he's the X factor, because that just sounds like he'd come in and do something crazy, but he's kind of the unknown guy in this whole situation. He was hurt all last year, recruited by the previous staff. Maybe he leaves this summer and it's a moot point, but I'm a little bit intrigued by him, at least as someone who can steady the ship in like a kind of Emory Jones injury situation.
I think that, Allen, may be the surprise for some Gator fans of the season if Jake Allen stays. I think Jake Allen's a very strong risk to transfer, but I also think Jake Allen is a very good candidate to win the backup job. I think he's very intelligent. I think this kind of offense will suit him with his ability to use his brain power pre-snap, post-snap. The spread offense is not a complicated one to run, but it does require good decision-making, quick decision-making, and accurate throwing. I think he could become an odd year kind of stopgap. So keep an eye on that one. That's definitely a good thing to mention. All right, transitioning gears a little bit to Dan Mullen. Obviously, Dan Mullen has had what most consider to be a very good start. Jack Lenatti asks, you've mentioned previously Dan Mullen is a high floor, low ceiling type of hire. Do you still believe that, Allen? And what specifically could change your mind and make him a high ceiling guy this time next year?
Wow, that's a great question. I still think that he hasn't done anything to disabuse me of that. I mean, he had a very solid recruiting class, which would, say something to be like the high floor. Like he's not going to come in. If he had come in and we had a number 40 ranked recruiting class, my thought of like, well, maybe his floor isn't that high, but he did what he did a great job, and, he didn't, astronomically blow it up, but he did about as good as you could have done. We talked about that last week or last pod. So what could change my mind over this next year? I think if we see some electricity from this offense that goes beyond what he was able to accomplish at Mississippi State, and the Florida fans we have in our memory, those title teams, which were very prolific on offense, but a little predictable, maybe, as some people felt. If we see him grow as a coordinator and head coach with the talent that he could get at Florida. So just maybe some more creativity and more energy in the program that I'm currently expecting us to have. So, what you hope with Scott Frost or Chip Kelly is that we're this lightning bolt of a program and all of a sudden we're crushing people on offense. I don't know if Dan Mullen's going to be able to get us there in year one. Maybe he will. And if that happens, I think the arrow moves up even further for me.
Yeah, this time next year, I think, is a good piece of the question. So we're assuming that we're done with recruiting. I would want to see a top five class. I think that the logical jump for the elite coaches is to do what Dan Mullen did this past year and then get into the top five. And then also what you mentioned, Alan, to piggyback on that, seeing an offensive strategy that is more exploitative, especially downfield, but also is essentially going to be very successful against the better teams in the league. You're going to hear me say this a lot with Dan Mullen as our head coach. The spread offense, as Dan Mullen runs it, is very successful against inferior opponents. I would expect that to be the case. How well it does against the elite SEC opponents will be the benchmark. If I see some improvement, that will be encouraging. But top five recruiting class and just improvement, I think, against those elite defenses would be enough for me to believe that maybe he is a medium ceiling kind of guy. I think the high ceiling type hype can only come after a second full year on the gridiron. I think that takes two full years to really kind of bump him from where I have him right now. And then Nick Karras asked a question that he loves to text me about all the time anyway. If Dan would throw deep on X percent of the receiving mismatches created by the spread offense, then James would love the offense. This is more or less true, Alan. I mean, the reality is, like I've said, the Patriots run a spread-based offense, and I'm not going to get into this again just yet. We'll save it for the season, but I've already covered it rather extensively. I like the concept of spreading teams out. I think that's a very good idea. I don't necessarily like how Dan Mullen and Urban Meyer tend to prefer attacking the 3 and 4 yard yardage markers and not the 10, 15, and 20 yard markers. So absolutely right, Nick. If Dan was choosing instead to go with a higher risk, higher reward style offense, where if you get the matchup you want, you throw deep, I would love that. Now, coincidentally, Alan, Emory Jones's high school team in Georgia ran very much that kind of offense. In fact, the majority of their throws were deep into the outside. The problem is those throws are not very open in college football. You can't simply run your slot receiver on an out and up and your wide receiver on a go route and expect those guys to be wide open. If you watch Emory Jones's high school tape, the majority of his vertical throws are just that. That is not going to happen in college football. So Nick, yes, that is essentially correct. And if that starts to happen next year and I see that we're a higher risk, high reward team, I think that would do wonders for what we'd be capable of achieving against the better teams in the SEC. At this point in time, Dan Mullen's got 12 or 13 years of tape as a college coordinator and coach, and very rarely did you see those kind of opportunities taken. So that's a huge question mark, and hopefully I'll wind up loving the offense, and we can reference your question a couple years later.
So I was watching some cut-ups of some film that David Wunderlich, he's year two on Twitter, fun follow. He was looking at some stuff from the UF Alabama 2008 championship game. And it was interesting to going through some of the play calls and some of Tim Tebow's progressions and some of the more crucial plays of that game. And there were moments where Alabama, I don't know if they forced us to throw deep, but they basically dared us to, or made that the obvious read. And we made some throws, and Tim made some great throws to Lewis Murphy and a few other people, where Tim read the defense correctly, found the mismatch. And, you know, for all the, I don't know, scorn that Tim Tebow got about his ability to read defenses at the NFL level, he could do it at a college level, if not perfectly, at least consistently enough to make big plays for the Gators. So if Emory Jones can do that, or whoever is back there at quarterback, I think those plays will be open. There are some opportunities to throw down the field, whether that's over the middle or deep down the sideline. And I think we'll hit some of those. If you watch some of the Dak Prescott years, you'll see him start to do that even more. And maybe Emory Jones won't be doing that as a freshman, but I think those opportunities are there. And I think that's at least still a possibility for me for this Dan Mullen-led offense. All right, let's skip down to a question from Scott Poyer. He says, glad to hear you guys again. Is the recruiting and talent gap between Georgia and Florida insurmountable? Is the next decade of the world's largest outdoor cocktail party going to be abject misery for Gators fans? James, what do you think? Is there a chance we can catch Georgia? Are they too far ahead?
Insurmountable is a difficult word choice there. But I'm going to say that it's not insurmountable. But I'm also going to say that the next decade, which is too far to predict anything, is probably going to be a lot of misery for Gator fans. You know, you've heard me sort of get on the depression wagon halfway through this season when it was clear that Kirby Smart knew what he was doing and that the recruiting level is absolutely insane. Yes, Georgia has an extremely good crop of talent right now coming out of that state that they're benefiting from. There are some things we still need to answer as time goes on. It is still very early. But if you're looking at what we're seeing right now, there is a large talent gap between Georgia and Florida. Large. And you would expect at least the next 3 years to bear that out. So if you had to bet, the probability is the next decade is definitely more miserable for Gator fans than any decade in the past 35 years has been for Florida fans. And it's hard to see that turning around, but that goes back to the original question we asked in the onset, Alan. A top five recruiting class next year will go a very long way towards helping to alleviate those concerns. If the gap continues to be Georgia's number one, two, or three, and we're number 10 or 11, we might not win a single one of those games. And that's not being depressive. That's, I think, being rather realistic, given what we've seen Kirby Smart do, how that team's going to operate. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch, I think, as we continue this podcast, to see sort of how that happens. But there is, in my opinion, right now, a very, very large gap between us and Georgia. I know not all Gator fans agree with that, but that's where I stand at the moment.
Yeah, this is one of those things where I could see two directions. One, where Georgia just outpaces us in talent, and they just grind us down because they're a juggernaut. They become Alabama East. But if we begin to recruit like they do, I think it becomes really interesting. James Doker mentioned an Auburn-Alabama dynamic, and I think implying, you know, Alabama, this talent-rich juggernaut, where Auburn is kind of interestingly, I don't know, good or awesome in certain years, and they pull some magic and beat Alabama. And that kind of mirrors us a little bit too, with Alabama being, you know, pro style, 3-4 heavy D, just like, you know, Kirby Smart's doing at Georgia. And we're running a spread, not the same spread as Auburn, but, you know, at least similar enough that those relationships kind of mirror one another. All right. So Alabama usually has more talent than Auburn, although Auburn is talented. Let's say that Dan Mullen is able to equalize the talent level. Would you rather be Alabama in this equation or Auburn? Like, you know, so Georgia, Florida, let's say the talent level is equal. Would you rather be the Alabama style process and program or the Dan Mullen spread?
Yeah, that's the age old question. And this is, you'll find different answers to this question depending on who you ask. I think everyone knows what my answer is going to be. I'd rather be the pro style team if all talent is equal, because the spread team relies on the talent being superior. That's just how it has to work. If talent is equal, when you're getting one-on-one matchups in space, now you're turning that into a coin flip situation at best. Whereas if you're a pro-style team and you're good at what you're doing, you're probably getting better than a coin flip in your good matchup situations. And I think that's really, Alan, how the Auburn-Alabama game has played out for a large piece of it. Auburn has stole some games from Alabama, but I think if you were being objective, Alabama was the better team in the majority of those games. And Auburn's been
making kicks. They would have won all of them.
They would have won all of them, right? And that's the thing. So Auburn's been cagey. They've played with them. But, I mean, let's be realistic here. And Auburn hasn't recruited as well, which is what you're asking. But I'm not sure how much that even changes if Auburn's recruiting was equal, because you still have that problem of an offense that relies on guys winning one-on-one. And let me give you the simplest example here. Alabama runs a lot of matchup man. Now, I say matchup man because they will switch. They're free to run zone principles individually between the corner and the nickel, and that changes the way a team plays defense. Very few teams are capable of doing that against a spread team. But because they are, that basically eliminates any read the quarterback has, and now he has to be able to just make a throw on a guy that is, in fact, covered. That is not an easy thing to do. Deshaun Watson had so much success because, as we learn in the NFL, Deshaun Watson could be an exceptionally great quarterback. So certainly that's always going to be successful in the college arena. But I think if we're talking about the probability here, I just haven't seen the spread the way Gus Malzahn runs it or the spread the way Dan Mullen runs it have consistent success against equal talent. If that changes, I assure you I'll be the first person to come on this podcast on the airwaves and say, I was wrong. I've been wrong about the spread option offense, the way it's run that way. It's better than running another style of offense against equal talent. I would be the first one to say that. But if I had to pick right now, I would take equal talent and the pro style of potentially what Georgia's going to run versus what we're going to run based upon what I've seen. But that's a great question, James. I think that's very much a good comparison. We very, very, very much could be the Auburn to Georgia's Alabama. And I think that's maybe how a lot of Gator fans kind of feel like we're going in that direction.
Well, you know, we've criticized Alabama, especially you, for, as you said, running a floor strategy where they're basically, let's minimize our mistakes and we'll just grind our opponent into the ground. And I think the thing with the spread offense that would give me hope against a team like that is just the potential for creativity and explosiveness that Alabama might not give you, that they're going to play so conservatively that, talent being equal, you could, I don't know, out-scheme them. And that's hard to say you would out-scheme Nick Saban, but maybe you would out-gamble him. Now, he's shown to be someone who will do what it takes to win, but the variance maybe is what you were looking for. That there's enough surprises in the spread offense in terms of playmaking. And also maybe the spread offense just fits Florida better. If we're going to have all of these speedy guys in the state, maybe just recruit a billion of them and we trot them out there and we make big plays. And that's how you beat a team like Georgia or Alabama, because you're not going to walk your way down the field against them. So that would give me a little bit of hope. Like if we're playing a ceiling strategy and they're playing a floor strategy, then that would maybe give you the upper hand. although I would expect Nick Saban to adjust to what anybody is doing. Let's talk a little bit bigger picture. Let's expand our scope to college football at large. James, walk us through a couple of those.
And let me just say amen to what you just said right there, Alan. The best way to beat Alabama or Georgia is to take a ceiling strategy. And the scariest thing is Georgia took the ceiling strategy in the game they played against Alabama. They went for broke in that game, and they forced Alabama to abandon what I think is a very poor strategy based upon what you saw happen. And that might be the scariest thing about Georgia being under division. But I think that's absolutely right. And that's why I think those downfield throws need to be more present, because I do not think you can win with these 3-yard plays. But well said. All right. So how do we see the next 5 years playing out in college football? Jacqueline Addy asks, what changes? Will there be any new faces beside Bama, Clemson, and Ohio State? Who might be on the rise? Who might be primed for a fall? So this is sort of the crystal ball strategic plan there for the next 5 years, Alan. Start me off with, will there be any new faces, do you think, besides the traditional ones up top right now?
The easy answer, or the safe answer, is to say no. If you look at the history of college football, there's not a lot of movement. I mean, there's people who rise and fall on the fringes, but the blue bloods have been the blue bloods for a long time. Now, sometimes people fall out of contention and stop being relevant. But generally, Florida is a weird school. So if you don't know the history of Florida football, we were pretty irrelevant before Steve Spurrier got there in the 90s and kind of awoke the sleeping giant. We're the first like new money school. We're like the last new money school really to like win multiple titles. I guess Clemson, you know, they have some history, but they're winning at a rate they haven't before. So there's always a possibility if you get a premier coach. I like what James Franklin is doing at Penn State. I think he's recruiting well. I think that they are a team on the rise. And the problem is he's got some stiff competition in that division. So you could see them compete for championships, but they're a blue blood. I don't know if that counts as a rise. It's hard to predict these things, obviously. I would think maybe Kevin Sumlin puts it together at Arizona. That could be a team I could see doing better than expected. Maybe Chip Kelly at UCLA. But those, I don't know if those are as surprising as maybe what you're looking for. I don't know you're ever going to see like, I don't know who's a random team, and like Kentucky or Kansas State become like a powerhouse and level of Ohio State. I don't know if that's possible in today's football. It'd have to be something of tremendous, like earth-shattering consequence for that to happen. What about you?
Yeah, new faces. I think Texas, and new face is not really a new face, right? But they, let's face it, they've been out of the national picture for a while. But I think you expect to see Texas there. You expect to see I expect to see Texas A&M there, and that will be a very new face. Texas A&M has not been a top five program, really.
That's true.
Yeah, really ever, if you really want to get down to it. And I expect them to be there with Jimbo Fisher. And so that will be an extremely new face. But does it count as really new, Alan? Probably not. I mean, Jimbo's done this before. It's one of the – I think it's the only – a precedent we've really seen in the modern football era where a guy like Jimbo Fisher leaves and goes to another school. So that's unique in its own case. But I do think Texas and A&M will be the ones that you see there. I think you'll see UCLA be cagey. That's what Chip Kelly does. I just really question how long he's going to be in college. I think it's pretty well known he wants to go back to the NFL. Primed for a fall might be interesting. I think Florida State is primed for a fall. With Willie Taggart.
Oh, that would be glorious.
Yeah, with Willie Taggart. I think that he's primed for a fall. I'm not sure about his actual head coaching ability. I think the state of Florida is very, very competitive. Florida State has been more or less in the national picture for better than 25, 30 years, minus 4 or 5 years there towards the end of Bowden's tenure. I think it's possible they fall out of the top five, and that would be unusual for college football for a time. So I think that's entirely realistic. And one to watch, I don't think Nebraska is going to be on the rise in that top five level because of the recruiting challenges. But I think Scott Frost and a guy like Sean McVay in Los Angeles, those two guys are the new face of college football. They run a multiple offense. Of course, I'm very biased. They do a lot of the things I really like. I am curious to see what can be done there. Keep an eye on Nebraska, because I do think that guys like Scott Frost and guys like Sean McVay, like, that's the new wave of football. That's how it's going to be. It's going to be multiple. It's going to be attacking what you're doing. It's going to be trying to punish you maximally for the kind of defense that you're running. And you know, those two guys, obviously one in the NFL, one in college, are sort of students of that. And in college right now, there's not a lot of coaches, Alan, that necessarily echo that at the moment that I've had coaching jobs. But maybe that's a broader look at it.
James, real quick, let me jump back in. And I can't believe I didn't mention, you know, podcast favorite Matt Campbell at Iowa State. If he's really serious about staying there, I think he's proven that he could be a guy who could win big there. Maybe he's Iowa State's Frank Beamer or Kansas State's, I can't think of Kansas State's coach. That's hilarious. Help me out, James.
I'm going to let you hang just like I had to hang myself when I couldn't remember anyone's name before.
The old man in the tennis shoes and the purple blazer. You know who I'm talking about. Those programs, or, you know, are there Bobby Bowden? Those programs are synonymous with a single coach in their rise. And so if he wants to stay at Iowa State long term, maybe, I mean, Iowa State has never been good ever, I don't think. And so if he got them to a place where they could win a Big 12 championship into the playoff, that's certainly a new face. So I don't know if he's capable of that. I don't know if that's possible at Iowa State, but I'm at least intrigued that I would even consider it a possibility. So that's kind of fun.
Yeah, and that's an Urban Meyer tree. And obviously Bill Snyder of Kansas State would be, you know, would be excited.
You're
to know
jerk,
that. Yeah. Sorry. I think the last podcast we did, I couldn't remember anyone's name. And so I know the feeling.
Just wanted you were on like a 1 hour sleep.
Yeah. I just wanted you to experience. You're normally super good with names, and I wanted you to experience what it feels like to just literally not be able to recall it. It's brutal. all right. What's the soonest?
Sorry, Bill.
What's the soonest you think is the realistic window that we could be national title contenders? The soonest realistic window?
Well, I mean, year two. That's the phenomenon that you see under the most elite coaches, that they can be in title contention by year two if they're stepping into a blue blood situation. I think the situation Dan Mullen's stepping into is there's at least a possibility of getting there. I don't know that that's true, but we've pointed towards, you know, this cycle this year was supposed to be when everything ramped up and peaked. Now, ultimately, you know, McElwain got fired, and so we had to reset a little bit. And so I haven't really looked at the timeline of all of our recruits, but year two or year three, if you're an elite coach, that's a possibility. I'm not predicting that, but I would say it's at least somewhat realistic if Dan Mullen is who Scott Strickland hopes he is.
Yeah, I think you nailed that question. Year two, you've heard in this podcast, if you've been a longtime listener, the three-year rule that I like to espouse, so certainly within 3 years, but the second year tends to be exactly what you said, Alan, just what you saw with Kirby Smart, just what you saw with most other coaches. The second year tends to be a massive leap forward, where if you're not contending for a national title, you're pretty close, and definitely by year three. What do we think the path to that point is on and off the field? Well, I think it's pretty clear off the field that it's recruiting. You have to have enough of those top 100 and top 300 guys. We've talked about that quite a bit. We certainly have increased our share of those this year, so that's good. You would expect to have a massive year next year, which would point to it. On the field, I think you have to see that you dominate the inferior opponents in your division and on your schedule, and that you are competitive in a non-fluky way against the top teams that you're facing. If you see those things, I think you can start to believe that, in fact, the future is very bright and you would be in the national title contending picture rather quickly.
Yeah, agree with that assessment. I mean, we're going to be able to tell a lot by mid of the first year, you know, mid-season of the first year. And then we'll have a lot of things in place by the end of the first year. And like we said, this time next year. Okay, Jay McWhorter asks, what does a successful season look like next year?
That's a very interesting question, Jay. I'm kind of looking at the schedule right now to just say, okay, you know, I don't want to just rip off how many wins we have or we're going to have. And let me just, Alan, quickly read you these teams. And then, you know, you can just give me an off-the-cuff gauge on this one. I know you asked me the question, but I'll read them. They'll both answer it. So we played Charleston Southern at home. Got to be a win, right? We play Kentucky at home. Kentucky's been cagey. I'm still going to expect to win there based upon recruiting alone. Colorado State at home. Win. So you're 3-0. Then you play at Tennessee, which really is in the midst of a serious turnover and change there, Alan. I would expect a win there. It should be. At Mississippi State, that could very well be a loss. Home against LSU, at Vanderbilt, Georgia, home against Missouri, home against South Carolina, home against Idaho, and then at Florida State. I mean, off the cuff here, Alan, this feels like 9 wins to me. We've got to have 9 wins at the least to be successful given that schedule. What do you think?
Yeah, obviously there's so much unknown in how this is going to play out. Less than 8 wins feels like stuff went way wrong. You got upset by somebody you shouldn't have. You didn't win a game that was 50-50. I mean, looking at the schedule, the only one that feels really daunting right now is the cocktail party. Of course, there's some very tough games. LSU, like you said, at Mississippi State. 9 wins feels appropriate. 9 wins, I think, would be successful without any caveats. And of course, we talked about last year, we really needed to see style over, you know, substance in some sense. We want to see the offense move forward. Next year, I think it's going to be about cobbling together wins. I don't think, hopefully we'll see flashes of where we're going to go offensively and defensively. Anytime you have this kind of transition, you're not looking at like peak consistency from anybody, but 9 wins would certainly be successful for me.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the mark. Now, obviously, like you mentioned, we might redefine success if Emory Jones goes out in week 1 and we have to handle other things, then the bar becomes different. But if you had to say that everything works the way you think it should work and people stay healthy, 9 wins and above is going to be a success, I think, based upon what the schedule looks like. And then I'm also going to say exactly what we said before this season, Alan. Success for me is going to be very style dependent. It's not just going to be about the wins and losses. It's going to be how we're getting them, what we look like against teams that are not as good as us and teams that are as good as us. It's not just going to be the number. So keep that in mind. On this podcast, I think we're huge proponents of what it looks like, not always what the number at the end of the season is. That can be very misleading. All right, this is definitely a question for you, Alan. Cameron McCaskill asks, who do you think will be the biggest surprise star on both offense and defense in the 2018 season?
This is fun question to answer right now because we know nothing. We haven't heard any spring reports or anything. You know, I mentioned Kenmore Gamble as a guy. I don't know when that podcast was, as a potential breakout star. And that was way off the top of the list. So this is a surprise. So, you know, if you're looking at the more notable guys, Tony Cleveland, Malik Davis, I would say maybe Ardarius Lemons becomes a guy who gets a ton of burn, more than you expect in a really crowded backfield. He's a guy who's shifty. He looked like he was out of control at times, but he has some nice top-end speed for a guy his size. I don't know that he's going to get the reps to really actualize that, but he could be a big surprise, and he could be a big play guy for this team, whether that's on kickoffs or just home runs out of the backfield. So that would be my guy on offense. On defense, I'm going to say something, I don't know, weird, but maybe Jeremiah Moon. He's a guy who is really highly rated for a linebacker, and he fits maybe a little bit more in that 3-4 scheme than where we were playing him last year. You know, hasn't shown much. He's been either injured or ineffective, but he could really benefit from this scheme change. And maybe he becomes a guy that's a real stalwart for us in making big plays. Anybody come to mind for you?
You know, this is a tricky question for me, because one, you're asking for a surprise, and Alan and I have like chronicled, I feel like, every player on the roster, so nothing feels like a surprise anymore. But I'm going to go with CeCe Jefferson on defense. And the reason that would be a surprise is I think, Alan, it's fair to say that he's definitely not lived up to the hype that was put on him. Fair assessment, right? So at this point in time, it would be a surprise if he became a star, because that's not typically what happens. But I think with the new defensive scheme we're going to have under Todd Grantham, he will have a chance to become a very realistically featured player. On offense, I think the question becomes very difficult, because the obvious star would be Emory Jones if everything's working correctly. That's obvious. I think, Alan, you took the next obvious pick as a surprise, would be a running back out of the system that would flourish. I liked that pick. I'm going to go with a tight end that's not going to be named, because it could be one of, you know, the two or three guys we have on the roster. It's just impossible to know without having seen really any of them play. But the tight end position, I think, has been a major disappointment for both you and I, Alan, in the McElwain era. We thought it was going to be good. So a surprise would be an actually very productive pass-catching tight end. That would be a surprise to me, and I would take that. And I don't know which one to name, so I'm just going to say that position, because that would be a very big surprise if we actually used that chess piece in a way that was effective for the team, something we just failed to do during the McElwain era.
Yeah, that's a good call. And CeCe is interesting, because I think he's been solid. He's been a productive player. He's been an anchor out there. You can rely on him. But for a five-star defensive end, you know, hasn't really lived up to the hype. Now, he's done better than the guy he was compared to, Byron Cowart, who's already transferred from Auburn. So be careful what you wish for sometimes in the recruiting process. But yes, if he becomes like a nationally recognized player, that would surprise me. And you're right, it's a possibility. And I hope that's true for CeCe, and that, you know, his return this year is everything he wants it to be and everything Gator fans want it to be. Okay, James, Marv 80 wants to know, if Dan Mullen and Scott Stricken called you tomorrow and they wanted to hire you as a consultant, what would be your top two recommendations? Maybe give one realistic one and one kind of moonshot or over the top one.
My moonshot one feels like maybe the realistic one. I don't know. Maybe it's one of the same. Okay. But I mean, my definite recommendation would be to be more exploitative. If you say that your long-term meta strategy is to try to gain 3 or 4 yards, as a consultant, I'm not going to be able to change that. So I'm confining myself to the consultancy seat here. I cannot entirely change a man's belief system. But I would say, be more exploitative. And what I mean by that is, be willing to leave your meta strategy and attempt to hit the home run far more often than you are. Far more often than you are. I'm not going to try to reinvent the wheel and say attack vertically first and then go to the flat second, but I'm going to say attack vertically more. And I think I would use a plethora of evidence and stats and film to say you're leaving opportunities on the table to pressure the defense here. So that'd be my probably realistic, but I also feel like it's kind of a moonshot until I see something different. I'm going to leave my answer to that question as that one. I think I would really hammer that home. I think a lot of the stuff that Dan Mullen has done, I've been very much on board with, hiring younger coaches, who specifically he's hired. The Todd Grantham hire might be a little bit of a question mark. He has good numbers. He's done good things. He might be the only guy that I see that I could maybe potentially have some film study issues with next year. But I think that'd be my main recommendation. How about you, Alan?
Yeah, this is the edge of the knife that you're walking with coaching, and, you know, it's player development versus bringing in talent. And those two often don't go hand in hand at the same coach. And so you need a mix. And if you're chasing Georgia, maybe you sacrifice a little bit of player development for guys that are home run hitters in the recruiting department, because you've got to catch them. Now, either that or you zag and you like, we're going to major on player development. So I would look at how the staff stacks up in those areas and how big of a swing do we need to make in that department. And I don't know if there's a moonshot one. You know, the facilities are improving. Things are going well in that area. I don't know if I have something that's really wild that I want them to do. There's nothing that's obviously we haven't done anything yet. There's nothing that's sticking in my craw that's like, why won't you guys do this? Or why won't you take a chance on that? So this is kind of disappointing answer to that question. I don't know that I have like something crazy that I want them to do.
I just thought of a moonshot. I just thought of one. I can't believe it didn't come to me. My major frustration with college athletics and especially the University of Florida is ticket prices. It's driving me crazy.
Yes, I was
crazy.
Just about to say that.
That's my moonshot is, hey, let go of yourself and drop the ticket prices drastically to make sure that the swamp is always completely full. Get rid of the $50 tickets. Get rid of the $80 tickets, whatever the case may be. If you want to sit in the sunshine seats upper deck, they're $5. They're $6, whatever the market allows so that it's full. Get rid of that junk. That would be my main number one thing, I think. That's a moonshot because clearly you'd have to convince the athletic department, but that's it. That's the one. As a consultant, I would hammer that home. I think it's ridiculous that these athletic departments don't just drop their ticket prices. It does not hurt your brand. It helps your brand. So that's my moonshot. There we go.
Yes. Okay. It's so funny. I was about to round into that and say dynamic pricing on tickets. And so when you're trying to entice people to come to the stadium, okay, I love what the Falcons did in offering cheap food. If I can come there and buy food at a reasonable price, that's cool. I almost never buy anything in the stadium unless I'm about to die and I have to have a Gatorade because it's so overpriced that I'm going to leave and be at my house in 10 minutes and I can't stomach the variance. It's like, you know, this burger, this crappy burger should cost a dollar and we're charging you whatever. I don't even know. I don't buy it because it's so crazy. But if you made things cheap, people would go, hey, let's go to the stadium and get some cheap food and good food. And it's almost a bonus instead of a penalty. Feels like you get penalized for going to the stadium because of the seat prices and the food prices, and they're gouging you. So used to be they're working from a position of strength. People are clamoring to get in here. We can charge them whatever we want. What if you shift your focus and, you know, because watching TV is so much better than it used to be. You're not watching a 13-inch CRT. So maximize the experience. Don't inhibit people from going. Take away the barriers to come, which are stadium prices, seat prices, and then see if you can up. You know, you have to provide everyone free Wi-Fi, but at least you'll have your phone and send texts at the stadium. So fix that too, whatever that takes. Good job consulting by us. All right. A topic that's been hot recently in college athletics. James, what are your thoughts on paying players?
My thoughts are absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I am obviously someone who leans towards individual freedom, individual expression, the recognition of value. Now, I also want to say something about that, Alan. A capitalist system is always going to create more economic inequality. It also is going to create a higher standard of living for those at the bottom end. College football is a wonderful example. If you institute paying players, the top players, the top 20%, are going to control 80% of the marketable income. The other players are actually going to get paid more than their current scholarships are, but there is going to be a very large income inequality, as it is when you pay people based upon their skill set. So that's the first thing that would have to happen. What does that mean? You're going to get super conferences. You're going to get things you already really have. As you mentioned, Alan, you're not going to see some new school come out of the woodwork and compete at a national championship level. There are too many barriers for them to do it. So now you're going to get these super conferences, and essentially you're going to get maybe 15 to 20 to 25 to 30 of these teams that can afford to pay more. And you probably create a salary cap and you do some things to make sure that it functions so that it's more or less how a lot of our other professional sport leagues become. And then you say, okay, well, James, you've just killed college football to become the minors. And that's exactly true. I think at the end of the day, Alan, the notion that these athletic departments can use people's likenesses, they can do all these various things with their stuff, they can promote them on national television ad nauseum, and these players who are more or less the brand, right, get nothing for it, is not an equitable situation. Now, I want to say that I absolutely think that there is value being given to people going to college for free and also getting exposure, right? College football gives guys like Baker Mayfield tons of exposure. I don't think there's a problem with delayed and deferred gratification. But I do think that the NCAA is a massive hypocrisy machine, as we're seeing continually. And it's not fair. If you want to defend the amateur, original student idea of sports, I'm all on board with you. But that argument to me falls apart when you look at how the NCAA truly operates. I have a problem with that argument there. These are not just students playing against other students. The way the coaches get paid, the revenue that's generated, how much we're talking about on this very podcast about sports, to me, making it more like what the European soccer teams do, what the German soccer teams do when it comes to paying kids in academies, giving them an education, making them professionals at the age of 14, 15, 16, 18, 19, 20, whatever, I think it's a more upstanding way to do it. It's a more upstanding way to do it. There's a contract, there are expectations, people know what they're getting into, and then you can go down that path. Nothing is perfect, Alan. There is no perfect way to do this. There's going to be pros and cons to both sides. But my thoughts are I'm favorable towards it. There are a whole lot of issues, Chris, with doing that. A whole lot of issues, which is why I would lean towards letting a free market handle that. I think it's the fastest way to get there. And then to put the bow back on this, that's going to reside with a lot of economic inequality. And I think people are very uncomfortable with that. There's a huge problem if you try to pay every player the same amount. Then where are you? You're in the same spot, right? So a lot of complications. I think that's the major hurdle as to why it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But I'm certainly in favor and okay with it. And I have thoughts on it, as you're hearing me say now. Now, Alan, I'm not sure what you're going to say, but I'm curious to hear it.
Yeah, I would go a similar but very different route. I don't think you can ever pay people. I think if you're trying to achieve equality or level the playing field, which is what the NCAA, why all these rules are in place so that people can compete. I don't think you pay the players because I don't think you can, because there's no way you can pay football players and not swimmers and divers. And if you just try to pay them all equally, you're still creating this artificial market, which then there'll be a black market on the side. So I think you just get rid of all of the NCAA regulation about outside payment. Sorry, the school's not paying, but if some booster wants to pay some dude a ton of money, if that's what the market, quote unquote, says he's worth, then let it happen. And I think the main argument that people come against this is, well, then teams like Alabama, Ohio State are going to pay more. They got so many more fans. They're going to pay more and they're just going to win every year. Well, that's already happening. So what would be the different outcome? And so I think the market would settle in. I think it'd be pretty wild at first, but I think people would start to see, I don't know if it's worth my money to pay it to this idiot high school defensive end to come here. And is that really worth my money? And if it is, they'll keep doing it. If not, they won't. And if, if you're a star like Baker Mayfield and people want to pay you to like advertise and stuff, like shoot, cash in. The reality is that a vast majority of players are worth like zero. No one is going to pay them for their services, right? So you don't rely on the schools, but you allow them to cash in on their likeness. If their, jerseys are selling, if people want to pay them, either like for their performance or to come to the school, I think that has got to be okay. I don't think we can continue to turn a blind eye, because you look at college basketball, it's happening. It's already happening. If you bring it out into light, maybe it becomes a little more less shady, a little more, I don't know, I want to say regulation because I'm anti-regulation, but you get less shady figures involved in it. So maybe that would help. So you basically just release the restrictions and allow the market to correct it. And you're right, the blue bloods are going to rise to the top like they have, but it's already what's happening. So you're not changing the outcomes. You're just kind of artificially covering it up and saying that the playing field is equal when clearly it's not.
Exactly. And this argument about amateur athletics, Alan, if you want to go watch amateur athletics, go watch the club teams play. They're available. Those are students, generally coached by students, playing against other students. They're available on any campus. But the fat reality of this is, Alan, we enjoy the extremely high quality that college football brings us, and we enjoy it in the wrapper of rooting for our school, because it creates a tie with which we experienced it when we were there. And that, I think, is the wrapper. I don't think that becomes any less special if athletes are paid. I do, however, really dislike the common sports culture where it's the owners versus the athletes and it's this dog-eat-dog business world. I don't think that's something that's beneficial. And I think in general, you'd rather see more harmonious relationships between players and owners, and it wouldn't be all about getting whatever is the max value for me, but there'd be more of a team component to that. That's just a side con, essentially, of right having paid at athletes in anything. All right, as we come down the pipe here, we're going to switch to some cultural questions and then talk a little bit of basketball. Jack asks, I went to UF in the early 90s. How has campus life, football interest, etc. changed since then? And has it changed for the better or for the worse?
Man, what a great and deep question. I think it has changed. For better or for worse, that's probably maybe a little too complicated to get it on the podcast. There's some good things about campus culture for now that's better, and there's some things that are worse. There's always things that are going on college campus. It's constantly shifting and changing. Football interest, I can say, certainly has waned, and rather dramatically, or I think over the last 15 years. Not that people aren't interested in football. I think there's a smaller number of people who are insane about football. Way more people I would encounter that are students who are studying and maybe will go to the game if studying allows them, who are interested and excited about football, but who aren't obsessives. There's not as many of those, I think. And you can tell just by the less full student section that it's not full all the time for every game.
Yeah, I think that you hit most of the points there. This is one of my favorite topics, Jack, to talk about. Campus life, I think, is much different now than it was when anyone who's under the age of probably maybe 32-ish, I'm going to say. I'm going to draw the line at a weird spot there, but I think that if you're under the age of 32 and you're over the age of 32, campus life for you probably felt a bit different. And I think a lot of that has to do with what's gone on with Facebook and technology and distractions. And this is my own personal point of view. You can feel free to disagree with this, but I think that a lot of us are living lives that are far less deep. Our relationships are not as deep if you're especially under the age of that 32 mark. You have a lot of surface relationships and you invest a lot of surface time, but it's difficult for you to focus and to be in depth and to be in the moment. And there's plenty of studies that back those thoughts up. I think being in the moment is a lot of what football life is suffering from. I think most of us can recall calling our phones for hours to get Georgia tickets, or waiting in line at the stadium to get in, or when you're at the football event, all you're really thinking about is the football event and the friends you're there with, per se. I think now people's minds are pulled in all sorts of directions, and they'd rather be texting or playing a game on their phone or at home studying, as you mentioned, Alan, or whatever the case may be. Campus life is a lot more distracted than it ever was before. And there are also a lot more options for entertainment, which has changed the nature of how deeply people care about the sport of football. So I think what you're seeing is the average person on campus is probably less passionate about football today than the average person was 15 and 25 years ago. And I think that's probably true, Alan, across the board. I think that's true across the board at just about every school. People will now show up for the spectacle. If you've got a massive game, they'll come to that. If it's something that everyone else is doing, they'll go do that. But I think as far as like the middle fan is less of a fan than the middle fan was before. And I think that's mainly what you see. You're always going to have the most interested fans. Most people listen to this podcast. You're always going to have them in any sport. But it's the average, the middle guy, that really determines whether or not it becomes a movement. As for whether or not you think that's better or worse, that's certainly an opinionated scenario. But I think that campus life is still similar, to kind of go to where Alan with that, as it was for when anyone else was in school. It's a coming of age time. You're meeting new people. You're having new experiences. I just wonder if some of those experiences that used to be in person have been traded for more of an online or behind a screen type experience, which if so, I would think that's important. All right. Daniel Johns asks us, what do you guys like to do in the off season? And maybe more interestingly, what is the optimal level of interest passionate fans should engage in while the football and basketball team rebuilds? Interesting question there, Daniel.
Yeah, well, maybe I'll answer the second question first. I think if you can unhook, I don't know, your expectations and live in where the football team is and basketball team is rather than where, quote unquote, should be all the time. Because it's hard. You want to enjoy the process. And expectations are a tricky thing. We all have them. But if you can reset them or, you know, not have them at the max all the time, I think those two experiences are much better, and appreciate where the programs are in the moment and where, what the process is. And don't go crazy during the summer. You know, summer is long for football fans and basketball fans. You know, don't obsess about what's happening, in practice or in, you know, in the weight room. You know, football, once August hits, you can start thinking about it. You know, 2 days will be right around the corner, but try to enjoy June and July and May. Watch some Gator baseball and softball. Those are awesome sports. I don't really know what to tell you to do in the middle of the summer. Enjoy the NBA playoffs, I guess. And after that, who knows? But get outside, run around. I don't know, James, what do you like to do during the offseason?
I think I'll answer the offseason question first. I like to do the same things in the offseason I do during the season. I like to travel. I like to lift. I like to play sports. I like to do things that are competitive. And I like to do a variety of things because I think that makes things fun. So with the variety of things being said, I think in the offseason, mainly what I care about, and that's really all I can answer this for as a passionate fan, is what's going on at the high level. Did we get enough top 100 and top 300 guys? What did everyone else get that we're competing with? Maybe what are some of the differences that are going on? And I think it's really important as a passionate fan to follow what your rivals are doing. A lot of times it's easy to get myopic and think, well, this is what our team is doing and all these practice reports and nobody can beat us. At times, if you can get yourself away from that and read about what Georgia is doing, what Alabama is doing, what A&M is doing, it will give you a far greater respect for how hard it is to win. And then when the season comes around, you've got a little bit more of a realistic expectation. As far as the basketball team, this season has been manic. And so I think as a fan, it's either made you want to lose all sense of reality and logical calmness. And then at times it's made you want to reach the height of euphoria. So it's been a very interesting and entertaining thing. I think in a way it's been a good offseason. I also happen to be a very unique person that I really like pro baseball. I'm a huge Baltimore Oriole fan. So for me, when most people are in like the midst of the doldrums of summer, I'm enjoying following the Orioles. I'll go catch a series every year in Baltimore. And so I actually enjoy that. It's a fun change for me. Football is my favorite sport for sure. But, you know, I think in general, follow your team at the high level strategic area. Avoid all of the hyped up practice reports and how each individual player is killing it and doing all this stuff, because that stuff doesn't really matter. Now, Alan, I'm going to let you steer this conversation, but I want to tee it up. We are headed into what I think is the most spectacular sporting spectacle and month-ish that now bleeds into April of the year. I think it beats the college football playoffs. I think it beats the opening season of college football. It beats the Super Bowl. It beats anything you want to look at. March Madness, to me, is the most fun. I essentially take off Thursday and Friday. I know last year you were at my house, Alan. We watched every single game of opening weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, with about 10 of us. It was absolutely amazing. There's nothing better than it. And nothing is better than March Madness when your team is in it. And after what looked like maybe we weren't going to get in there, the Gators will be in it. And with that, if those of you that just do not like basketball, we can bid you adieu. Thanks for listening to the podcast. We look forward to hearing you next time when we cover the spring podcast. If basketball is something you care about, we're not going to spend a terribly long time on this, but we're going to set the table for what to expect from the Gators heading into March Madness.
Yeah, this is, like you said, a schizo team with a weird basketball season overall. So it's kind of interesting to project forward what's going to happen. James, how are you feeling about the team right now? Maybe I'll give my answer first real quick, but I'm encouraged by this recent trend. Obviously, the team has been up and down. They'll win several, lose several, win a game they shouldn't, inexplicably lose a game they shouldn't. But I've liked the toughness of this team over these last really four games, even though they lost the Tennessee game. I thought they showed a lot of heart and courage, and I think they've improved on defense. They've improved in their shot selection. And I think that they're peaking. I don't know if peaking is the right word. They're at least rounding into shape to be competitive in March. So I'm encouraged right now. What about you?
I'm very encouraged. I had made a social media post a couple of weeks ago that basically we're not going to make the tournament. I mean, we had three or four games on the road against better competition. And if you look at this SEC tournament this week, Alan, it's pretty fascinating. We've lost to the number 11, 12, and 13 teams in the SEC as far as the seeding goes, and we've beaten most of the top teams. We have, I believe, 10 quadrant one wins, quadrant one being against the elite competition in college. I think we're 10-3 against those teams, which puts us second or third best in the country behind North Carolina and Kansas. And we also have horrible losses. You know, the loss we took to Loyola Chicago, which looks like a good loss now. They just won their conference on Sunday. They're a very, very good team. They're 28 or 29-5. Okay, nice. Not bad. That team can beat you. And we've had, you know, double-digit leads against teams we should have waxed, and we've lost by 20 points against teams we shouldn't have. It's difficult to reconcile what's gone on. I feel like the narrative was we came out of the gates firing. We were very solid. There was a game plan put out there to beat us. We really could never get over that. Reached a bottom point a couple of weeks ago where it looked like the wheels were falling off. And then we regathered ourselves and really have finished very, very strongly, generating a lot of turnovers on defense, playing more capable offense, if you will, rather than disappearing for 8 minutes. We disappeared for maybe 6 or 7 at the earlier stage of the second half. I don't know. I think we went, 10 minutes in the Kentucky game, scoring only 3 points. So there's still all these weird question marks with this team. But I think Mike White deserves credit for pulling them off the mat. We were in the midst of a free fall. It did not feel like we were going to get off the mat, Alan. And we did. I think as we head into March, it's important to remember what kind of team this is. When I'm doing my bracket, I like to look at teams that have won at least 6 games in a row. I think if you have not won 6 games in a row before, there's no reason to think you're going to win 6 games in a row in the tournament. It's just not going to happen. So I just eliminate them, right? That's number one. Number two is how long have your losing streaks been? Have you lost a bunch in a row? Well, we have. We're kind of on either side of those things. So this team, I think for sure, Alan, is a team that you don't want to see in your bracket if you're a Virginia fan or you're a Xavier fan or you're a Duke fan or you're a North Carolina fan or, you know, on and on and on. You don't want to see us in your bracket. We're not a team that you want to play against because we can beat anyone. But we also can lose to anyone. And I think the key to our March Madness run is going to be the bracket. If we get a bracket that allows us to play against teams that play an up-tempo offensive style, I think we're golden. If we get a bracket where we're with a bunch of teams that play half-court, grinded-out defense, I think we're in a lot of trouble. And so I think this team could be a Final Four team, and I think they could be bounced out you know, the first weekend. I think either one is entirely possible. And when I see this bracket draw, Alan, I know you and I have a good time talking about it, I think it'll be a lot more insightful. But I'm going to give you a key player here for the stretch run. And I think he was key for us last year, so you may already know who this is. But I think that we need Gack to become a guy that could get 15 minutes a game, 15 minutes a game, pull down some boards, and score a few buckets underneath. We missed him terribly when he wasn't there. He's not polished. He still struggles. He's a sophomore. Doesn't have a ton of game. But we are so unbalanced when he's not there. And Hayes is not a guy, Alan, that I think can play 25, 30 minutes at a high level. So I'm going to say that Gack is our X factor. I'm going to say he's the guy. If we can play at times like against Kentucky two bigs, I think we were successful with that. I think if Gack can steal minutes, if he can play well, if he can stay out of foul trouble, I think we could make a deep run. And that might sound like a crazy X factor to you if you follow this team, but pay close attention to what Gack does in the tournament. I do think he is a very important guy for us because he's one of the only guys that can assist us in the front court. And we just have been lacking there so much that if we can play him and Hayes together and keep them out of foul trouble at times against these teams that are bigger than us, I think it presents an opportunity for us to finish off some of these games we develop leads in.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment there. I mean, we haven't had Gak for large stretches of the season because of his health. But if we can keep him moving and keep him healthy, I think that's an interesting little X factor there. I mean, I want to give Mike White some credit. This has got to be a really difficult team to coach. Not only are you missing basically a whole section of the team, like with your biggest, strongest players, which really limits the types of things you can do as a team. This is a team without a lot of leadership. This has been talked a lot about, you know, not a lot of very vocal leaders or guys who are, I think, you know, natural leaders. And so he's had to kind of will them forward. And you can kind of mark the season with Kayvon Allen's play. This is a guy who is all SEC last year, expected to be a star. I think people thought he could be SEC player of the year. And he's been terrible for stretches, invisible. For a guy who's as accomplished as he is, that's stunning. Florida has this weird history of guys doing this, whether it's Brett Nelson or Kenny Boynton. I don't know. People are regressing as they get older. Now it's under different coaching staff, so I don't know what the link is there. But if he's playing well, Florida tends to really look good. I don't think we've had a game where him and Igor and Keystone and Jaden Hudson have all played well. I think if we get three of those guys playing well and shooting well, it would be very difficult to beat. I love Keystone. When he's playing well and we have him involved in the offense, and if you're not guarding him, he's going to drill threes. I love his shot. I would rather him not dribble drive too much. And then can Jalen Hudson be effective and aggressive on offense? And so I don't know. I think, like you said, we can beat anybody and we can lose to anybody. So Gator fans, don't be too sad if we go out in the first round, be a little disappointed, but that's possible. This team is also capable of making it to the Final Four, especially if it gets hot on the right weekend. I don't know that there's a team in college basketball that is a juggernaut and so dominant that we couldn't hold up against them. I would not like to play Michigan State because of their size. But other than that, I don't know. We could seriously beat anybody. That feels crazy to say, but like you said, with the right draw, it could happen. James, over under us getting through the Sweet 16.
Ooh, without seeing the bracket, ooh, that's tough.
Yeah.
I would say, because I can't see the bracket, that it's a true coin flip for me. I think coin flip is the right answer. I want to say more than that because we have ingredients that are compelling. We have a guy in Chiozza who's got a lot of tournament experience. Those guys do really well in the tournament. They can carry you. They can win a game by themselves. And Chiozza's also been struggling mightily to shoot the basketball. So there's just like you mentioned, there's a lot of ways this can go. But I would put it literally at a coin flip. I think we're a true coin flip to get through the Sweet 16. I would expect us to get there. I know I said in our basketball preview ep when Justin was here that the Sweet 16 would be the success mark. We needed to be a Sweet 16 team this year. I still believe that. I still believe that this team needs to be Sweet 16 for me to mark this year as a success. But I take it a coin flip at this. And, you know, Justin may have nailed it the whole season before it started when he said he thinks the team's going to go to the Final Four. It's going to be a very frustrating team. It's going to take a lot of frustrating losses. And it's going to be a team that has a lot of very satisfying wins. And he nailed it. I mean, he nailed the season in that one or two sentence statement right there. And now the question is, how do we remember this season? If we get to the Sweet 16, I think we look at it as, that's a good season. If we get to the Elite Eight or Final Four, we really remember it fondly. And if we bounce out of the first weekend, I think we remember it with frustration. That's how important this basketball tournament is. It defines your entire feeling towards an entire basketball season.
Yeah, for me, I would, if I had to, you know, take my own little over-under here, I'm going to take the over, meaning I think we make it through the first weekend. I don't think I could really count on us being consistent enough to win six games or even, you know, four games. I will be disappointed. I'll try to measure that if we get bounced in a 5-12 game or a 4-13 or 6-11 or whatever it might be. depending on the matchups. But I think if we make it out of that first weekend, I think you can say job well done. This team achieved at a high level considering its limitations personnel-wise. And, you know, it would have been definitely a frustrating up and down season with some high highs and low lows. But it will be a memorable team nonetheless. So, like you said, I love March Madness. Love it. I'm disappointed I'm not going to be there in Gville with you guys. But I think the Gators can make a run. I'm excited to see where we land in the draw, and I'm hopeful that it's a good one for us. Any last thoughts on the tournament itself?
Well, I want to get one more bet out of you. 4 seed, 5 okay. seed, or 6 seed?
I like it. I'm going to say, let's say that we win. Well, I won't put any caveats on there. I'm going to say 4 seed. I think we win a couple games in the SEC tournament. I like our draw, and maybe that moves us up to a 4 seed.
Yeah, I think our resume is one that this committee is going to want to overseed. So I think that we'll be a 4, even if there may, after this week's tournament, be merit for us to be a 5. I think we'll be a 4, and I think we'll be one of the more curious 4s in a while. So it should be rather interesting. Alan, any other thoughts before we close this episode?
No, I just want to say thanks for sending in some questions. Let us know if there's other topics you want us to get to in the offseason. And, you know, I don't know what our production schedule is going to be, but we'd love to keep things rolling every once in a while and get back to you guys. We'll certainly talk about the spring game, but let us know if there's other things you want us to talk about.
Yeah, and you guys have been awesome. Seriously, Alan and I have done this whole year in the Russia and the Gainesville, and we have just so thoroughly enjoyed providing the show for you, getting feedback, comments. People have sent us Reddit threads, and we've seen stuff on Patreon, and we're overwhelmed and overjoyed with the support and how much you guys like the show. So we certainly appreciate the heck out of that. Thanks for letting us know and giving your feedback, and please continue to do that going forward in the future. You know, we really do produce this show for your entertainment and your enjoyment. And if you have ideas and thoughts and things you want us to do, send it in and we'll do our best to incorporate it.
All right. With that, let's close it up. Enjoy March Madness, everybody. And we'll see you guys at the spring game.